Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner. I'm a programmer at TIFF now, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Ned Benson, a writer and director who made a stunning debut with his two-part drama, The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, in 2013, which starred Jessica Chastain and James McAvoy as a couple sent spiraling in very different directions after a tragedy. Since then, he's been doing a lot of writing, most notably supplying the story for Marvel's Black Widow, and only just delivered his second feature, The Greatest Hits, a fantastical romance about a young woman, played by Lucy Boynton, trying to save her boyfriend from a fatal car crash through short-term time travel, only to find an unexpected connection with someone else in the present. It's streaming right now on Hulu in the US and Disney Plus everywhere else, and it's really good. You should check it out. Ned picked After Hours, Martin Scorsese's frantic 1985 comedy starring Griffin Dunne as a New York office drone who meets a nice girl in a cafe, goes down to Soho to see her again that night, and finds himself lost in a hostile wonderland of deadpan sirens, paranoid ice cream truck drivers, slam-dancing punks, and cranky cat burglars, played by a magnificent ensemble that includes Rosanna Arquette, Linda Fiorentino, Catherine O'Hara, Terry Garr, Verna Bloom, Cheech and Chong, Bronson Pinchot, Will Patton, John Hurt, and Dick Miller. It's funny and scary and just a little bit sad, because different rules apply after hours. This is someone else's movie.
I just love the representation of New York it gives. I grew up in New York City, and it really just gives me this nostalgic throwback to the city that I grew up in. And I think there's just this madcap, wonderful Alice in Wonderland kind of Wizard of Oz experience you have with, you know, the Paul Hackett character coming from uptown, being this word processor, and then running into what was a Soho that doesn't exist anymore. So I think it's just the nostalgia of seeing New York in that way, and this idea of, you know, also like you need your phone. You can have you don't even need a card to get in the subway anymore. You just use your phone. And, you know, I think taking a taxi or anything is so much easier. Like, you could get home. And back then, if you didn't have enough money for the subway, or if you didn't have any cash, like, there was no way you could move around the city. So I think this funny thing that happens to him, obviously, is just he goes downtown, loses his money immediately, and he's basically stuck for the night, you know, in this experience. And it just gets crazier and crazier as the night goes on. So I just love the New York of it all, the New York of it as a character in it, but also just, I think the actors in it are so great. You know, we had Griffin Dunne, and I'm also having this big, like, Rosanna Arquette moment where I've watched that movie and Desperately Seeking Susan back to again, you know, like, very close together. And I'm just like so enamored at, like, how amazing she was, and like what a great actor, and just with this presence that and charisma that she had.
Yeah, she sort of, I kept watching it again this time in that gorgeous new Criterion edition, which I have to put in a plug for because they do probably the most important work on the planet for film. But watching her in this, I kept thinking, is this where the manic pixie dream girl comes from? And I don't think it is, but she's legitimately manic, right? The character has something that she's fighting against, or something that's going on with her that Paul doesn't even notice because he's not looking for that. But Scorsese and Arquette make sure we see it. And that pivots the film in a different direction, especially on repeat viewings. Just that smile that she has, that sort of easy, fast smile, feels more and more like a front on repeat viewings. And it just pulls you in more closely to the character, to the performance. But that, yeah, between this and Desperately Seeking Susan, in that moment, right? Like, this was the woman who personified, like, an American independent movement, the New York side of things. And it's remarkable and wonderful to see her so confident in each performance and so different that it wasn't just a gimmick that was being used by other filmmakers. She was participating in it and crafting this character, who we only see for, what, the first two reels?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's just something so dynamic in her performance. Like, she can go from so deadpan to just all over the place. So it's really, as you said, not to make her the template for the manic pixie dream girl, but she really goes, like, from 0 to 60 so quickly in her expressions, and then back to zero. And it's really special, like, to watch. And it's just so fun. And my wife had watched it with me and just was giggling the entire time because it's such a funny movie and she's so funny. But the other thing I really love about these performances is Scorsese's letting the behavior tell the story. Mm-hmm. Like, so like Griffin Dunne is like, he's down in Soho, he's confronting these people and like their behavior is like completely out of control, but you don't know what the subtext is. And you're sort of like unpeeling the onion as you go. And I just love storytelling like that, because I think you're allowing the character to really give you piece by piece, like what's actually going on with them. And it's like sitting in a cafe, which is kind of how, you know, they're sitting in the diner, it's the movie begins, but it's like sitting next to someone and overhearing what's going on in their lives and making your assumptions as you go along. And I think that's what real life is in a way too. So it's nice to be in a movie where you're kind of like sitting next door to the characters and in this, like, at this table or whatever, and just kind of figuring out what's going on as you go.
Yeah. And he does callbacks too. The script keeps looping back and bringing in other characters. I saw this, I guess I would have been 16 maybe in 85. And I saw this at a suburban basement shopping mall theater in Toronto with an audience that had absolutely no idea how to take it. And the second in Toronto, of course, if Catherine O'Hara is in your movie, that's your constant. That's the locus around which everything must revolve because of Second City and her reputation in as a Canadian superstar by that point. But I continue to come back to her performance too, because we see her at two separate points with considerable distance or considerable chaos between them. And she is this anchor of whatever it is she's doing. She's legitimately angry. 40 years later, her character seems pretty much dead on about everything she's upset with in the world and in terms of her relationships with every individual she comes across. She's just the most take charge of everybody. But she also seems to catch, Fiorentino does it too, but O'Hara really embodies the New York thing of, as long as nobody gets in your way, they're cool. And the second she hits a speed bump, like the whole movie is about Paul not listening to people. And by dismissing her at the very beginning, it comes back around to him and everything else goes to hell. But he's the interloper in an ecosystem where everything else is going fine. I mean, obviously, except for Rosanna Arquette's character, but that's probably not his fault as much as he wants it, as much as the world wants to blame him for it. He just read something wrong. And I know I'm mansplaining this from his perspective at this point, but she's on the trajectory she's on. And I think what I see in Arquette's performance now is the sense that she's grasping for something nice and she doesn't get it because he's just not capable of giving her what she needs because he's oblivious. And he introduces this, you know, it's a game of mousetrap or it's a Rube Goldberg machine, whatever it is. He pushes one thing out of balance and the entire world comes around and decides he must be punished for it. But O'Hara is this, she's the Avenger. Like she's the avatar of this lower Manhattan anger. Everybody else is doing kind of crappy things to each other, but she is the one who's pointing at people and blaming them. And she's the closest thing the plot has to a protagonist, or not an antagonist, to an antagonist in her way. And because it's Catherine O'Hara, the audience with my screening was on her side right away. And it was fascinating. Because it's clearly not the point of view of the movie. She's another complication. But watching the push and pull, and I think the film could be viewed from the perspective of almost any character that way, that everybody is the centerpiece of like everybody is the protagonist of their own story in this movie, and they just want to get to the other side of it. And Paul is simply the one we happen to follow for the tiny duration of time that we follow him.
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously when you, Catherine O'Hara is just such presence. So like anytime she shows up in a movie, you're happy. Like I think her stepping out of that cab, which of course is exactly the same cab that he took downtown at that moment. But you know, like this sort of incident between them that sort of becomes their relationship of the movie. And initially she's just like I want to help you out. Let me patch you up. And then she won't let him go. It's like this Venus flytrap, you know. She walks up into his apartment and he's trying to make the phone call. He's calling 411. She just keeps on telling the telephone numbers, like, and he's like, what are you doing? I think is so fun because she starts as this kind of like flirty, you know, like helpful Good Samaritan, and then, you know, becomes this, you know, the hunter in a weird way. Like, once, I think this, obviously, I don't, you know, people who haven't seen the movie, but like, you know, there's this, these burglars on the loose. So basically he's finger pointed as this burglar, and she leads the charge against him. But it's just such a fun performance. I think it's so funny, you know, having him be the lens of this movie and sort of go from experience to experience with each of these characters. And it's almost like vignettes that you go through in terms of like moving through the circles of hell for him in a weird way. But I think the thing that I realized in rewatching it was that it's about a man who's not really living his life, you know, who opens himself up to experience, and really it becomes about the double-edged sword of experience. Like, yes, you open yourself up to, you know, this whole new world, but at the same time, like that world can bite you back. So, you know, it just is it's just a fun, awesome ride in that way that, you know, falling down the rabbit hole, but I think going to Soho is, you know.
Hey, it's Norm interrupting my own show to bring you up to speed on Shiny Things, my newsletter about physical media, culture, and the odd streaming project. Last week, I wrote about Warner's new 4K releases of Martin Scorsese's The Departed and Steven Soderbergh's Ocean's Trilogy, which, frankly, were just what I needed. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at shiny-things.ghost.io or find a link at the Semcast Blue Sky account. You like reading about movies? I like writing about them. Come check it out. And the experience of Soho now, I mean, the scene location comparisons that are out there in the world are absolutely fascinating, because, as you say, it does not reflect. This film captures what looks like a combat zone. My favorite thing about watching Chud was noticing the same locations, because it's also set in roughly the same area. So it's in what's, some of it's in what's Tribeca now. It's even further south. But back to back, this sort of sense of a completely abandoned city created by, I guess, well, this is what, 10 years after the budget collapse and the New York to, what was it, Ford to New York dropped in, all that stuff.
77 or whatever.
Yeah, you're looking at the wreckage of it. Yeah. It's like 5 or 6 years later, and it's before the revitalization, it's before Giuliani and the Disneyfication of everything in Manhattan, it's before Sex and the City, and it doesn't even look like the same world. And Paul, you know, he's a comfortable office worker. He's got money. You know, he's got enough money that he can just go downtown with nothing but a 20, because of course, you know, tell the kids today you could do that in New York. They won't believe you. But the collision of what's happening uptown, you know, he's working in this beautifully laid out loft office building with computers that are presumably state of the art. We don't actually know what he does. He tries to explain it a couple of times, I think.
Word processor, I think, is the best they
yeah. But is it, you know, is he doing it for something? Like, is he a copy editor? We have no idea. Is he just entering text into something? Because that was a whole job back then. But he is absolutely anonymous until he gets down to Lower Manhattan, where he sticks out like a sore thumb. And he gets threatened and chased and mohawked and all the other fun stuff that happens over the course of an hour and a half. And Griffin Dunne is exactly who you want for that role. That's the other thing. Like, he is contemporary for that period, right? Like, he looks like he's utterly out of place in a world of artists and punks and thugs, even though he is the artist who's working to, like, his company developed the play in the first place. He was the one who optioned it with Amy Robinson to make the film, which was supposed to be directed by Tim Burton, amazingly enough.
And I know, yeah, I read that. I read that it was Tim Burton.
I don't know that, this sounds weird, but I don't think Dunne would have fit into a Tim Burton movie in 1984, right? Like, this is before Pee-wee and Beetlejuice, where his work was even more gothic and bizarre because he was still an animator. And Scorsese finds a realism that I'm sure would have eluded Burton. It would have been a nightmare film in a different way.
Oh, it would have been a completely different movie. I mean, you can imagine the production design on it. And because it is weirdly this like comic horror movie, I mean, I don't even know what to describe the genre as, because it's like a satire as well. But it would have been a very interesting Tim Burton movie. I would have been so curious to see it, but you think about what his Batman looked like, or, mm-hmm. you know, think about Edward Scissorhands or Pee-wee, you know, it would have been a definitely more of a fantasy than it was the reality that I think Scorsese made it into. But I think it's just the perfect Scorsese movie, because, you know, you just look at that Michael Bauhaus like camera work and those just like dolly zooms and pushes, and just like there's so much fun happening, and it has such an energy to it. And thinking about just riding in a taxi cab downstairs and speeding up the frame rate, and just like it's hilarious to see all the fun he was having to make it as insane as a ride as it became.
It's a juggernaut, right? Like it's a freight train, even though so much of it is him just sitting quietly waiting to see what to do next or what new problem is about to arise. Your heart rate is always slightly raised. My wife has a term for this sort of movie. She calls it bad decision theater, where the wrong thing is the thing that propels the plot. So it has to happen. And not every movie does that organically. I mean, we've all seen films where, you know, people act illogically in order to keep the plot going, because otherwise there's no movie. But in this case, it feels like Dunn has this desperation that Scorsese keys into. We have spent just enough time with him that we know he doesn't mean anyone any ill. And so we watch him panic. Basically 10 minutes into the picture, everything, the money goes out the window, and everything is a negotiation. Everything is a compromise. Everything is an escape. And the music, as well as the cinematography, just keeps pushing. It won't let you breathe. And
There's that ticking clock in it as well. You know, yeah. It's like perpetual throughout the movie. It has that, like, again, that Alice in Wonderland, like there's all these like clocks and watches throughout the movie that are reminding you about the time. And it's just so fun.
With no sense of escape.
No sense of escape. And the way it begins is so simple, you know, like he's sitting with Bronson Pinchot, like, and he's like, oh, this is a temp job. I couldn't bear to do this the rest of my life. And that sort of hits Paul so hard. And then when he's home alone, and then he goes out to read Henry Miller, and he's sitting in the diner, and he sees Roseanne Arquette or Marcy, like, and she connects on that book. I think once he gets her number, he's like totally open to, he feels the necessity to open himself up to experience, because I think all he's been shown is how closed his experience is. And I think a lot of what it becomes is just this, okay, experience after experience after experience, until he's enclosed in this paper mache statue that ultimately he breaks out of, like a chrysalis or something, you know, and is reborn in a weird way.
Yeah, it's a perfect metaphor. And you'd said it's like a trip through hell. Doesn't the last layer of Dante's Inferno require you to actually crawl through excrement for an eternity, so you would come out coated with it? The Shawshank Redemption stole that now, so that's where we have it in people's minds. But yeah, and the other thing that I learned, I think it's somewhere in the Criterion Edition, was that that wasn't the original ending.
Hmm.
The Burton version didn't have that ending. I don't know what the original ending was. I assume Paul never got out of something. Either he got trapped in the statue or Lower Manhattan forever. But Michael Powell came up with this. He said he has to end up back where he started. It has to be a circle. So you can wonder, you leave the theater wondering if he's learned anything.
Yeah. No, I'm interested to see. Joseph Minion wrote the script, I think it was.
Yeah, it was a stage play originally.
Yeah, so I'm curious what the initial, or at least his draft, had the ending as versus like what was initially there. But I think you're right. It had to be a return. Like, I think there had to be this full circle experience of he went through something and was transformed by it, despite the madness of it all. And I think the question that I'm asking myself about the movie is like, was this experience worth it to him or not? Because it is so insane what he goes through. But I think it winds up being positive to a degree, you know, like I think we need the insanity of experience to help define who we are in the face of it.
That's a pretty reasonable interpretation. Yeah, I think so. Certainly the movie, the score seems to think that it's at least we leave on a high. So we are allowed to go out with you know, like propulsive music and just be flung back into our world. Into our lives. So I think it's either an upbeat ending or a boy, aren't you glad you're not this guy kind of thing, carried through the city by Cheech and Chong and thrown out of the back of a van.
I just love like just the madcap cameos. You know, you have Cheech and Chong as the burglars. I mean, John Hurt as the bartender. You know, Terry Garr, I think, is just hilarious in it. I mean, she's so funny. And just the, I think the other thing I love about it is just the late night New Yorkness of it all that I experienced as a teenager and in college, you know, just like when you would go downtown and showbuck at back up at home, like when the sun was coming up. And there's this, as you said, like this emptiness to the city back then that I don't think exists anymore. You know, it really felt like the Wild West once you went to a certain point, and it just was a whole other world and space. So, and I think it just captures it so perfectly in the design with the cinematography, you know, just like the idea of showing up to Linda Fiorentino's like loft and her dropping the keys off of the top of the building to let him in is, you know, perfectly captures what New York used to be.
And the keys are still terrifying. They come right at the lens. Like they're barreling at us. So we're already nervous and we're in Paul's head already, which that probably felt like what Lower Manhattan felt like then too. I mean, you shot what, like 2/3 of Eleanor Rigby is that neighborhood, right? Like it's Cooper Union and Astor Square and all the Soho stuff.
Yeah. We shot all through there, Lower East Side. Yeah. So as much as we could, you know, but yeah, all through Alphabet City and Lower East Side. And
did you chase any location? Was there any one location that you were kind of hoping to catch from After Hours, just as a comparison?
I mean, it's so hard to shoot in Soho. Hilariously, I've shot like Cadillac commercials in Soho because of course, like GM can afford to do that. But I think on an indie movie budget, we were just lucky to get any street that we could close off. And by the way, we couldn't even close off the streets. So we were walking with extras the whole time, or regular people the whole time. So
it just builds the world. It worked for me. The other question I always ask, I always wrap with on the podcast is if there's anything of the movie that we're talking about that you have borrowed or lifted or outright stolen in your own work. I don't really see it for the greatest hits.
Thematically, I think, and maybe I'm reaching, but it does this idea of a person who's isolated and kind of trying to chase experience again, or at least figure out how to experience the world again and re-engage in life. I think thematically there's some shared territory. I mean, they're completely different movies tonally, but I think in rewatching this movie, there's just such an energy to it that I love. I mean, Scorsese has so much energy in his camera work. And but this one, it was just fun to sort of look at the camera work and really think about what I can lift for something next, you know? So it definitely inspired me in terms of thinking about the nostalgia of New York and making movies that are about times and places in New York that I miss and love for sure.
Yeah. And it did occur to me too, that both The Greatest Hits and Eleanor Rigby are sort of in conversation with each other about how we move forward or backwards and how we can lose ourselves in the idea of being the person we used to be, even though we're not that person anymore. The key line obviously from Rigby is he got soft, I stayed hard, but this is somebody who's, In The Greatest Hits, Harriet is somebody who's desperately trying to stay soft and doesn't understand how to articulate it. And I just found that such a powerful, like moving extension of Rigby that, you know, stasis isn't the solution to anything. Mm-hmm. And 10 years on, like, how are you relating to these themes? I mean, do you find an evolution or a connection?
For sure. But I think we all, you know, I look back at that movie and there's a version of myself that doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, I think that's what that movie was about too. And I think looking at After Hours or this current movie, The Greatest Hits, like it's about the versions of ourselves that we are. And like, sometimes we have to let go of these versions, you know, of ourselves and realize that we are different people in different moments in our lives, and the collective you know, greatest, you know, but it's like different chapters in a book that become, you know, who we become. But I think it's really about letting go of different parts of ourselves and different versions of our lives that, you know, we can't be anymore. And I think that's the beautiful and heartbreaking part of being a human being.
And in either case, we hopefully whichever version we end up being, we'll still be able to watch, you know, our favorite movies here and there. It's only about music in your film. I was kind of wondering about that. Was there ever a temptation to do something about film or cinema, or was it just the music had to be the connective tissue?
This one, I just think I'm so affected by music and as a medium, you know, it just so easily had that kind of Proustian like throwback feel to me. But I, you know, at some point I would love to make a movie about film, you know, film on film in a day for night kind of way. We can talk about day for night, you know, next time.
Ooh, nobody's done it yet.
Okay. Well, 10 years from now, we'll do it.
My thanks to Ned Benson, whose lovely new film, The Greatest Hits, is now streaming on Hulu in the US and Disney Plus everywhere else. Thanks also to Ginny Monaco. She knows what she did. Ned's not on social media, but you can find After Hours on disc in that Criterion edition I mentioned. The 4K version is gorgeous, by the way. It's also streaming on the Criterion channel and available to rent or buy on various VOD services across North America. And go find The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, which is one of the best movies of the last decade in its original two-part cut. You won't regret it. You can find me on Blue Sky at Norm Wilner, and you can find this podcast there at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. The first year of the show is still available for just $20 at payhip.com/Semcast. That's the first 52 episodes of Someone Else's Movie, 44 of which aren't currently available anywhere else. And check out my newsletter, Shiny Things, at shiny-things.ghost.io. I think you'll enjoy it. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review wherever you've been listening. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're doing that. Stay safe, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out, get the new booster when you can. I'll see you next week for episode 500. Ridiculous.